Next up on This Week in Law, we have a huge treat for you. We have a really wonderful warrior in the patent wars, Lee Cheng, who is general counsel for Newegg. We're going to talk all about Newegg's trials and tribulations in the trial court, how they do not settle patent cases, and they're having a great track record with it. Jonathan Bailey joins us, too, from Plagiarism Today. We're going to talk a bit about copyright curriculum in the schools. Evan Brown is here with us as well. Next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 229, recorded September 27, 2013. Trolling, trolling, troll hide. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWIL. Hey folks, it's Denise Howell here, and oh my goodness, we have such an exciting show for you today. I am so thrilled. We have Uber patent warrior Lee Cheng with us from Newegg. Lee, if you have not heard of him, is right up there on my list of favorite lawyers of all time. And you're going to see why in just a few minutes. Hello, Lee. Great to have you.
Thank you, Denise. I'm very glad to have this chance to chat with your audience and to share my perspectives about patent trolls and the complete imbalance that we currently have in our legal system in favor of people who can abusively assert patents.
So Lee is general counsel of Newegg. And for those of you who don't follow these things as closely as we might here on the show, Newegg had a big victory in a patent trolling case not too long ago this year, lost a trial in East Texas, as most people do when they have to go and try their patent cases there, but then won on appeal and had the final nail in the coffin on appeal happen just a couple of weeks ago now, right, Lee?
Well, we thought that it was the final nail because, you know, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the next level up from the trial court, they were pretty definitive in terms of what they thought were the merits of this patent troll's, legal arguments. And this is a patent troll that claimed to own the rights to the online shopping cart, which is a total joke, you know, and they've extorted tens of millions of dollars legally because, you know, legally from companies that just settled out to avoid the cost of litigation. Over the years, and they have a franchise where they sue people, and you know they try to get people to settle because of the cost of defense is so high. So I've gotten word that potentially the troll is going to try to extend its franchise a little bit longer, and it was an answer to a prayer. I actually publicly begged God to let this troll waste more of their money, their ill-gotten gains. By filing a petition for the Supreme Court to review the Federal Circuit decision. And I've been told they intend to do that because I think they have a couple of cases still active in where they're trying to get money from people on the off chance, extremely remote chance that somehow their bad patents will be revived. And as long as they technically do not have that final ruling from the Supreme mm-hmm. Court. They yeah. can still try to negotiate with people by, you know, to get something because the cost of defense, again, is quite so high. So I'm hoping right. that this report from my counsel is true and that they're going to file a petition for the Supreme Court to hear their case. I would like nothing less. I would love to have the opportunity to I think show them that again in another forum to drive that final nail into the coffin.
Yes. Well, we're going to get into the details of all of that and where the case stands in just a minute here. I do need to welcome the rest of our panel for today. Evan Brown, my co-host from Chicago, Illinois, and the InfoLaw Group. Hello, Evan.
That's right. Yeah. Hello. I'd forgotten. I was just already into the conversation mentally. It's like, yeah.
Need to let folks know you're here.
All right. Good to see you, Denise. Happy Friday. Hi, Lee. Hi, Jonathan. Great to be here and looking forward to our conversation.
Hey, Evan.
Me too. Jonathan Bailey is with us as well, a frequent visitor to This Week in Law. We're great to have you back, Jonathan. Jonathan.
I can't. Yeah, it's cutting out on me. Sorry.
We've been having some video. We've been having some technical difficulties with Jonathan. We're going to try and keep Jonathan with us. We'll see how that goes. If not, we're going to get him back again on This Week in Law real soon. You can't control the internet when it fails to cooperate with you. But as we began to do there at the beginning of the show, let us jump right into the topic of patents and patent trolls.
I never feel more patriotic than when we're getting ready to talk about patents for some reason. I don't know what that is.
Yes. Although it doesn't, the current state of the law on patents and the fact that we're still trying to work our way through to some kind of patent reform that would address trolls doesn't make me feel all that patriotic. You know, we live in a country where lawsuits like the one that Newegg was involved in happen all the time. And I haven't really seen a hockey stick graph lately, Lee, of percentage of patent cases filed and whether there's a lot of volume increase year over year based on the fact that trolling is becoming such a popular sport. Do you happen to know those numbers?
I can't remember them off the top of my head. I think, on a very broad and general basis, I mean, the number of lawsuits being filed is absolutely increasing. It's literally in the thousands. I believe it's somewhere between 4,000 to 5,000 cases. And, notwithstanding, I think a study done by the GAO recently that reported that only 20% of patent litigation is filed by non-practicing entities. I actually think, and I'll publicly say this, I think the GAO basically just got it completely wrong. They must have used an incredibly narrow definition of a non-practicing entity. The reality is, so many people ask, what is a patent troll, right? And patent trolls especially like to challenge characterizations of themselves as patent trolls. I think over the 8 years I've been in the trenches in the troll wars, what I've come to identify as a patent troll is really form agnostic. It's really based upon what someone does. It's how they assert a patent or what kind of patent they assert. So in my view, a patent troll is any person or entity who engages in patent trolling, which is either the assertion of a very bad patent that intrinsically is valueless, or the abusive assertion of a patent to try to extract purely litigation-based, cost of defense-based premiums from many victims. And the reason that, in all likelihood, I think the volume of patent litigation is likely to rise is because trolls have evolved into a model where they believe, identified, it's almost a foolproof, completely riskless opportunity to make a lot of money. They sue a lot of companies, or they send demand letters to a lot of companies, big and small. And the cost of response, simply responding to a single, demand or to a lawsuit, is generally so prohibitively high that most companies will write the check. And these trolls will collect millions of dollars with a patent that isn't really worth spit and has added no value to anybody's lives. And it's a real pity. There are no negative consequences to these actions, because the standards for award of fees, for fee shifting in this country, because we're quite so committed to the concept of access to justice, means that even when people win lawsuits, It's very hard. You would have to show, meet the high standard of showing objective baselessness and potentially objective baselessness and bad faith potentially. And in order to get your fees back, and these troll entities are just shell companies. They do nothing but sue or threaten to sue. And even when you win, even when you win a pittance back and are awarded, say, costs, you get nothing. The troll actually will just, the principals of the troll will just file for bankruptcy. So there's no negative consequence to this type of extremely negative, non-productive activity that unfortunately is uniquely American. There's no other country in the world with this phenomenon of patent trolling in particular, it's a real pity. It's costing the economy billions of dollars, tens of billions. The Bessent Mirror report suggested that in 2011 the cost of trolling was $80 billion at the least. I think it's much higher than that in terms of lost productivity, blocked innovation. I mean, I hear from app developers. I've talked to app developers, small companies, and trolls love targeting them because they can't defend themselves. I mean, they don't have the money to hire a lawyer to file a responsive lawsuit. So I just talked to a CEO of a company yesterday who paid, something in the order of $30,000 to $50,000, to settle with a troll, earlier this year. He just got sued by another company asking for roughly the same amount of money that's represented by the same law firm. And the math is terrible, because defending yourself costs multiple times more. And so, a lot of these small companies are actually driven out of business. The app developers can't write their apps. Newegg probably wouldn't exist if the phenomenon of trolling existed. So just to clarify something, Denise, I think this is something we're quite proud of. We didn't just win a single lawsuit this year. We actually haven't lost any patent lawsuits ever. We have won 4 favorable decisions just this year at the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. One was an complete overturn of a Texas trial court decision, and it invalidated 3 patents held by the shopping cart troll, Sovereign Software. And the other one was an affirmation of a complete defense verdict against a corporate troll called Alcatel-Lucent. A lot of companies, unfortunately, that can't figure out how to make money by building things people want to pay money for. They've decided that they're going to, figure out, turn to, imbalances, find imbalances in the legal system to try to force people to give them money for, patents that have never been used really as the basis, or referred to do anything. I mean, they broadly interpret these patents and they leverage these inequities in the legal system to squeeze licenses out of people. So we beat Alcatel-Lucent's butt like a drum, very proudly. And they tried to appeal this to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit, wrote a decision 3 days after the oral arguments affirming the trial jury's verdict. We also got an affirmation of a summary judgment motion against a notorious troll called Kalora that had gone after probably in the order of hundreds of companies. Kalora was asserting a close to expired patent, and we have been informed that over time they collected at least $4 million in settlements using, if I remember correctly, it was a contingency fee counsel. And they were represented actually by a big law firm that pitches for a lot of defense work. So people should know about this. It's the Manat firm. And oh, wow. People should know not to use firms that – they should ask their lawyers whether or not they represent trolls, because there's no other field of litigation where, a lot of big law firms who are, just chasing the dollar play both sides of the field. So, I'm going to call Manat out and just tell the world or all of your listening public that – they represent patent trolls. They represent Kalora. And Kalora lost twice. They extended their franchise by appealing the summary judgment win at the trial court level to the Federal Circuit. We got an affirmation from the Federal Circuit. And then we actually had costs awarded in Kalora. So it's a pittance compared to what everyone collectively spent to defend and validate the Kalora patent. but the costs were something in the order of $330,000 for about 10 different parties, and then Clora files for bankruptcy. You know, that's just great.
Yeah.
Okay. And the principles of Clora, the way the trolls are modeled, they've distributed all the money out. You know, Manat got theirs, and you know, the troll got all their money. And, you know, right now they're saying they can't afford to reimburse people for $330,000 worth of cost. And we're being told that, well, gee, potentially the patents in the bankruptcy estate could be, you know, resold. And potentially the troll principal or other trolls can buy these patents, the non-invalidated patents. That's just great.
Rise from the dead. You know? Yeah.
You know, so we've won. So we've gotten 4 favorable decisions. We've never lost after appeal. We've invalidated every single patent, and it just tells you how weak and terrible these patents are. But they're not going to be challenged because the legal system is structurally stacked right now, structurally, substantively, and procedurally stacked against people on the buy side of intellectual property.
So let's talk about the sovereign case that you mentioned in the roster of cases that you guys have hit out of the ballpark. And that's the one that you said at the top of the show, although you've had a complete victory now in the federal circuit, you understand that there may be a petition for certiorari filed. This is what your sources are telling
you. That's what we have heard. We have heard because I believe they're still in litigation against a couple of companies. Right. So
remind us who settled with them before your case went to trial.
Everybody they sued settled with them. Mm-hmm. So their patents are based on a lot of these business method patents were filed in the 90s and at the turn of the century. And, I was at a startup company, frankly, right around that time frame. And I remember people filing patents because they thought it would make their valuation look better for VCs. Nobody ever really thought these patents were worth spit, you know. So these companies, a lot of these companies never managed to do anything that would create enough value for people to actually pay them for their product or services. Right. You know, and they would they rushed to the PTO. The Internet was very new. The U.S. PTO granted a lot of these patents. Stamp. And a ton, and the companies then failed. Some of them actually went public, but then they failed because they couldn't make products that added value to customers' lives. And this particular set of patents was owned by a company called OpenTable. And I'm sorry, OpenMarket. My apologies to OpenTable. Yes. OpenMarket. And OpenMarket blew up, and their patents were bought by Divine Interventures, which was a fairly largest Chicago-based VC fund incubator. And Divine blew up. And then somebody who worked at Divine, who was the president, became the president of Sovereign Software, and Catherine Wolanik, a former Latham lawyer, worked with folks to buy the patents out of the bankruptcy estate for, you know, not a huge amount. And they put together an extremely, extremely clever strategy of suing people to realize enormous profit. I mean, in all of this, I think, you know, these quote-unquote opportunities, they came really to the fore right around sort of the early part of the last decade, because of lawsuits like NTPs versus BlackBerry. People realize, my God, there is a giant loophole in the law, in the area of patent law. You know, all you have to do before eBay v. Merck Exchange is to get somebody at a trial level to state that a patent is valid. And then you get an injunction. And then you can shut a big operating company down and cost them millions, if not billions of dollars. So they're going to have to pay you off, even if the patent's invalid. Oh, and gee, the model's beautiful. And we can sue lots and lots of different companies. There's the pleading standards are loose. You know, we can go to certain venues that, that have very welcoming procedural rules, you know, very loose discovery rules, calling for the production of anything, quote unquote, relevant that are hard to get to. And, you know, we can use a photocopier essentially to crank out complaints against, you know, or file a, you know, before the IAA file complaints against, you know, dozens of defendants at a time, or a lot of defendants. And it's a money machine. So Sovereign sued. Sovereign had a strategy that seemed to be, let's go after the big ones first and then, you know, start rolling up the others. So they went after Amazon first in 2005. And I think the Gap.com. And because, unfortunately, at that time, eBay v. Merck Exchange, you know, hadn't been decided by the Supreme Court, and injunction standards were easy to get, Amazon was forced to settle, and Amazon paid them $40 million, you know, to settle their litigation. We were sued with four other companies. And we're basically the mid-majors of e-tail, you know, Zappos, CDW, Systemax, and Red Cats. In 2000, I think around seven or so, no licensing letter, just a lawsuit in East Texas. And they asked for a lot of money from us, and everybody else settled. We were told by our outside counsel that we were advised by our initial outside counsel that it was probably, you know, that it was prudent to consider doing what everybody else kind of did. And the system was pretty kind of stacked against us, and, you know, and we had a lot of risk, blah, 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 blah. And in fact, you know, Sovereign, when we finally took it to trial, Sovereign demanded $34 million from us. You know, now how their patent added any value to anybody, and how their patent could have helped us build our business or bring, you know, value and convenience to our customers' lives is completely beyond me. It's a farce, total joke. How many millions of websites are up that all have shopping carts, and how many have blown up, and how many are Newegg.com? And the answer is none, right? There's only one Newegg.com, and we got to where we are not because we have a shopping cart, you know, which has very clear and obvious analogs both in the brick and mortar world as well as in, you know, prior, you know, channels, you know, but yet they said you should give us a certain percentage of your overall revenue. Then, you know, based on a completely, you know, erroneous theory of damages, the entire market value theory, right? And thankfully, the jury, you know, in the trial court, you know, they came to a conclusion that, you know, their patents were valid, and we indirectly infringed a handful of claims, but the damages award was survivable, sustainable for us. And we took it up on appeal, and we had every reason. I personally, honestly, I was 100% confident that we could not have a bad outcome on appeal under extant case law, because essentially the business model, which I, in my opinion, is a scam, relies on the fact that, you know, most companies don't want to spend the cost of defense. It's hideously expensive. We spent more money overall on appeal and trial, winning this lawsuit, than Sovereign initially demanded. But the reason we didn't settle was because the writing was clear and on the wall. If we paid Sovereign, we'd have to pay everybody. We were hit with four lawsuits alleging infringement of some aspect of search technology. There are at least a dozen patents that I'm aware of that cover search technology. So you give a percent here, you give a percent there, and pretty soon your business is crippled. Any company that settles, their customers need to understand that they're paying. The cost, it's not free. The costs are being passed on straight to them. I mean, there's a toll of the troll, and it's hitting every single consumer in America, because we're all on the buy side of patented IP. Now, don't get me wrong. I think patents have value. I'm a firm believer in intellectual property rights and protecting them very vigorously. I don't think that the value assigned to patents under our current system of law, substantively and procedurally, reflects anything close to their intrinsic value. You know, and patents should not be charged for at a premium just because it costs too much to invalidate them, or it costs too much to defend against an allegation of infringement. So going back to Sovereign, you know, we came out of trial court with a modest damages award, and it took us 2.5 years to get the Court of Appeals to go through the appeals process. But the Court of Appeals invalidated every single one of Sovereign's patents, you know, just lock, stock, barrel. And we felt vindicated. And then, of course, Sovereign tried to appeal that panel decision, tried to seek en banc review, fail, right? Fail.
Right.
We took another case, Alcatel-Lucent, a troll to trial. And Alcatel, very, very sadly, was such a crown jewel, at least the Lucent part, was a crown jewel of American industry. You know, such a proud history coming from all the way from, you know, the Bell, from Bell Labs, you know, and such a history of true innovation, of contribution to society. And as with a lot of companies that just kind of get big and successful and very rich, well, I think they stopped making products that customers found competitive, you know, on by and large, or enough to pay for their overhead. And their financial results turned out to be not so good. And, you know, I think somebody got the bright idea that they had 27,000 patents that should be, quote unquote, monetizing best as possible. So they engaged in extremely aggressive, what they call a licensing campaign. And this isn't against competitors of theirs. This is against, you know, the universe. I can't even tell you like how many tens of thousands of letters they sent out. But I, you know, everybody, I, you know, almost everybody I know got one, right? And the pitch was very similar. You know, here are six patents we think you infringe. You know, and if you, and we actually took the time and we spent tens of thousands of dollars to have these patents reviewed, and we were told they don't infringe. You know, we don't in fact infringe. And in fact, some of these patents are probably invalid. And we told, we communicated that, and we, along with other companies, so I can say this now because other people have had the same experience and they shared it publicly. They were, we brought it back and they were told, oh, well, we have 27,000 other patents. We probably infringed something. So just give us some money. Right. And this is a joke. You know, this is shame on the people at ALU and on their corporate leaders who can't figure out how to make, you know, an honest buck here. Right. So we said, we're not settling. We're just not settling. And we marched into trial with our good friends from Overstock. Unfortunately, you know, our friends at Amazon and you know, other companies were forced to settle, you know, but we got a full defense verdict. In that case, we invalidated their patent outright. And, you know, that's also very gratifying. And, our, you know, Alcatel hired one of the best law firms in America. With, you know, one of the two of the top lawyers in America, Seth Waxman, very famous appellate counsel, and another gentleman. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but Seth is, you know, the leader of a practice at appellate practice at former Solicitor General of the United States.
Yes.
At WilmerHale. And, you know, he's undertaken to sort of be the apparently I think he's undertaken to become the advocate of final sort of, you know, the advocate of last what's the phrase I'm looking for? He's you know, the last chance sort of advocate for a bunch of patent trolls. But, you know, at the Federal Circuit, you know, they just affirmed the decision at the trial court level. And the Alcatel patent's dead. That is a doornail. Nobody ever has to pay that troll toll again. And we're very proud of that work. We're proud of the work that we did with a number of other companies who stood up to Kelora. We're proud of the work that we're doing right now, pursuing justice against some of these smash and grab trolls that think that they can get away with suing companies and demanding $30,000 to $50,000, you know, suing dozens of companies and demanding $30,000 to $50,000. And gee, when they collected enough money and they realized that, you know, some defendants won't settle like Newegg, they actually just dismissed the lawsuit with prejudice. And they just dismissed the lawsuit and they say, Mulligan, you know, you spent a couple hundred thousand dollars on defense. Mulligan, thank you for everyone else's money. What are you going to do to us? So our position is, well, screw you guys. We're going to make you remember that when you file a frivolous lawsuit against Newegg, it's going to have a negative consequence. If you think you can just walk away because the standards for seeking fees is very high, think again, because we're going to file a fee motion and we're going to appeal every single adverse decision until the law changes in this field. And we and other companies are doing the same thing right now. God bless them.
Yep. If we had a live audience right now, you'd be hearing a roar of applause, I'm sure. And I'll give you my own version of it here. One thing that struck me about the Sovereign case is if CompuServe hadn't existed back in the day, you might be in a very different boat than you're in right now. That it was not the amorphous nature of the patents themselves that were their downfall, but the prior art piece and the fact that way back when CompuServe had a shopping mall with a shopping part, and that's what carried the day in invalidating these patents. So I understand, I haven't read through all the appellate briefing in your case, but I have written my share of appellate briefs, and I know that you never make one argument. You always have fallbacks. You make your best argument, and then you give the court 10 other reasons.
Denise,
to
there's
find
so much art. There's actually so much art.
Yeah.
There's so much art, right? And procedurally, one of the areas where the deck is kind of stacked against defendants in trial courts is mm-hmm. when this is pre-AIA, but even kind of now in trial courts is, you know, a lot of cases end up getting consolidated. Defendants basically have to all share time to tell their stories, whereas the plaintiffs have all half the time to tell their story, and the multi-defendants have to sort of split the remaining half to tell their stories. And you have to be selective about the arguments that you present, because otherwise you run out of time. There's plenty mm-hmm. of art, you know, mm-hmm. for Christ's sake, this is a freaking shopping cart. Mm-hmm. They called it a shopping cart, right? Their other two patents covered, you know, what I would probably charitably characterize as essentially a cash register and a receipt, right? Mm-hmm. It's CompuServe wasn't the only, it's not the only art out there. And there's a lot of other art that's buried in corporate archives, you know, that go back to sort of the dial-up days, or even before the dial-up days. And to tell you the truth, right, the law I want to make, and I'm happy to disclose this, and if there are any trolls out there listening to this, I'm happy to share my strategy with them, right? It just cuts down on inefficiencies. You know, we approached patent trolling, the patent trolling phenomenon here at Newegg strategically. This is part of our strategy, right, to benefit our customers and to be a good corporate citizen, and we approached our defense very strategically. We're trying to make some good law here. And as gratifying as the invalidation was, we are setting up all of our, every single case that we're in to try to make law in the area of damages. That's the war, you know, mm-hmm. That's the war. If you make it uneconomical for people to pursue frivolous patent claims, I think there's going to be a severe curtailing in the phenomenon of patent trolling. The fact that we invalidated, the patent, it meant that we never even got to the wonderful non-infringement arguments we had. Yeah. And the fact that we didn't infringe and the patent was invalidated meant that we never ended up being able to get to the demand, the law that we're trying to make in the area of damages. And yeah, it is what it is. I'll take it. I'll take sure. a victory, right? But, and this is one way, again, where, you know, I think procedurally, substantively, I think laws are somewhat stacked against the buy side, the use side of intellectual property, and very much supportive of litigation industries, of which patent trolling is only the latest manifestation. Before patent trolling, you have securities class action, you have mass torts, you have all sorts of stuff. It's not an accident that a lot of plaintiffs' lawyers in the patent world, are converted class action folks, are converted PI guys. It's not an accident. You know, after mm-hmm. patent trolling, after we reduced it to the nuisance rent that it should be, there's going to be something else.
Right. And that was one thing that
we're going to reduce it as quickly as we can. I mean, we're going to try to do our part to evolve this area of litigation so that we accelerate the evolution of trolling so that it only exerts a nuisance level effect on the American economy.
Well, more power to you. And I'm sure that our listeners are thrilled that you have taken this strategic approach. One of the things you just mentioned is, you know, the sort of lawyers who typically go into the patent trolling business. I would not have thought graduates of Latham and Watkins would have been in that category until I learned of your case. That really surprised me. Folks at, you know, big, established, respected, and in this case, California-based firms would go down the road of, you know, I've done my stint at a big firm. The next latest, greatest thing I'm going to do is form my own non-practicing entity and go forth. That one kind of blindsided me.
It's all about the money, though, right?
Yeah.
It's all about the money. And lawyers, especially lawyers at big law firms, they're very highly intelligent people, very, very high IQs. You know, and they identified a tremendous opportunity, and in a twisted way, they're entrepreneurs. I mean, they're basically legal entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Same way any plaintiff's lawyers are legal entrepreneurs. A large number of trolls were founded, in fact, by alumni of big law firms. You know, by people out of Jones Day, by people out of Fish and Richardson, by people out of Fish and Richardson spawned a ton of trolls. Mm. You know, people out of Kirkland and Ellis. You know, and this is a business opportunity that lawyers are very uniquely suited. You know, suited to pursue, and you know, the smart people can always find ways to make money, I don't think anybody should be surprised, you know, that very smart people, you know, not only identified this opportunity, chose to pursue it, but, they chose to pursue this opportunity. And the question then is, what are the rest of us going to do about it? And you know, one other thing that they're able to do is, in many cases, just frankly, at least in my opinion, they figure out great ways to rationalize, you know, what they do. And what they're doing is nothing short of advantage taking, of deficiencies in patent laws and deficiencies in our legal system. And, you know, they figure out ways to rationalize what's happening as well. We're standing up for the little guy inventor in the garage who otherwise, you know, couldn't get any returns on their patents, you know, and everybody has sympathy for the little guy inventors. But I can guarantee you, if anybody looked at how the proceeds of trolling got divided up, you know, the amount flowing to actual inventors is a micro fraction of the amounts flowing to lawyers and to investors, you know, in patents. This is not something that's spurring innovation. This is not something that's spurring the right kind of innovation, certainly. You know, and again, this is not the first time that lawyers from big law firms have popped out to take advantage of such deficiencies in the legal system. So don't be surprised. You know, I guess
yes.
The question is really, what are we all going to do about it?
Yes, and I want to get to the question of what we're going to do about it in just a minute here and talk about some of the reform proposals on the table. Before I do that, we should go ahead and insert our first MCLE passphrase into the show. I think I'll make it the little guy in light of what we've just been discussing here. Now, we put these passphrases into the show in case you are listening for continuing legal or other professional educational credit in your jurisdiction. If you need more information about that, go to wiki.twit.tv, find our show This Week in Law, and we've got a whole page there that will help you along those lines. Evan, before we start talking about reform, do you have any questions for Lee about the litigation they've been involved in?
Was it fun? I guess would be that one. No. I mean, I guess more of just a comment. I mean, I don't think there would be a finer exposition of the case against patent trolling, and Lee, you're aptly calling it the deficiency in the legal system. You know, if you ask a patent troll, I guess they wouldn't agree that it's a deficiency. It is just what the system will provide, and it's an opportunity that's there. And in a free market economy, we can take that. I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if a reasonable person sits down and tries to think of a way to come to the defense of a patent troll, and at least some of the things that patent trolls say that they benefit the public interest in some way. And I think you were touching this on the end, and I'm just wondering if you would comment on it. You know, there's this group, for example, it's Acacia Research Group, where they claim that they will go and help inventors who have not been able to be successful in monetizing. You know, if you read the testimonials on Acacia Research Group's website, they talk about inventors' widows, for example, who have passed away, but they were able to use that patent in a way that benefited the inventor, kind of carried it on like that. And in that sense, also spurs innovation, or at least furthers the innovation. Another big argument that you see in defense of patent trolls is how, you know, having these patents out there being asserted actually causes startups and other companies, not necessarily startups, but even maybe ventures the size of Newegg, to actually do new innovations to get around that. And that raises the sum total of benefit to society.
So much
as much
crap.
As there is.
All right. Well, so why
do you say that?
So much crap. You know, if we had to spend six times as much to figure out how to write a shopping cart, right? That, you know, if fundamentally there are a whole bunch of problems wrong with our patent laws, right? Relatively on a relative basis, and one of the issues I think where the ship's kind of sailed is around subject matter patentability. We're one of the few countries in the world that allows like business methods and software to be patented, as opposed to be properly and protected under a copyright regime. And if you think about sort of the nature of software and the nature of you know, the web, internet, e-commerce, you know, there are just so many different ways to code for the same functionality that, you know, the fact that you grant a protection, you have a protection regime as deep and you know, as patent law for every single one of these possible variations of, you know, the same type of functionality. It just permits, you know, multiple excessive, you know, and you couple it with all of the procedural advantages that plaintiffs have in our legal system. It basically just creates this massive amount of, massive amount of rent that people have to pay in order to get something very simple done and straightforward that could benefit society. Now, going back to the point about, you know, the benefits to the alleged benefits to the mom and pop or the solo inventor in the garage, again, no one's really done an economic study, but I'll bet I can put a large sum of money on the table that individual inventors get a micro fraction of the monies that are paid to trolls every single year, and that are you know, the cost of trolls every single year. Most of the money goes to lawyers and to investors, and as opposed to individual inventors. Maybe a case it can trot out, you know, a story of a widow that they helped enrich. Maybe, you know, I don't know, Eric Spangenberg can point to one guy who filed a patent that that they helped get a sizable amount of money. Those stories are on the whole, I think, very, very rare. I think the reality is that and this kind of goes to the fundamental, you know, I think the fundamental there's a very fundamental question about, again, that needs to be addressed, you know, which is, you know, does our system, a patent law system, procedurally and substantively place far too much value on the ideation, you know, behind a patent as opposed to the implementation of a patent? And then I think you have to, you know, look back on the purpose behind, you know, the patent laws themselves, or Patent Act, original Patent Act itself, right? To I think really responsibly answer that question. I mean, as I looked at the Patent Act and the history of the Patent Act was put into place not to make inventors rich. It was put into place in order to benefit society. And if an invention does not actually benefit society, then, you know, presumably I would say that the inventor should get as rich. It should not get a windfall. There's nothing in the Patent Act in the rationale behind the Patent Act that says that the goal was to, you know, optimize wealth for someone who comes up with an idea. The goal was to benefit society. And right now what we have is a system that basically says ideation can result in a giant windfall. And it's unclear, and actually it's not just unclear, it's very obvious that in many cases, certainly with certain areas of technology, the ideation actually didn't benefit anybody except for a lawyer who basically took the patent, you know, and translated it into legalese. And if anything, you know, and the way that our patent laws are currently enforced, it also, basically inhibits the implementation side. It inhibits entrepreneurism. You know, we basically never had, I mean, I can say that with complete assurance. My software engineers had absolutely no idea and never referred to anybody's idea or patent, you know, in coding for something that I think they and every single most sane people would say and fair people would say is obvious, right? Coding for the online equivalent of a shopping cart. They never had the benefit of you know, got any benefit from that, you know, patent. And mm-hmm. yet we were being told, you know, that our success was due to this idea. This is very similar. I think what the trolls are trying to articulate is a theory that's very similar to somebody basically, you know, staking a claim in a piece of scrubland, you know, and saying that, you know, anybody who walks through that piece of scrubland has to pay downtown Manhattan rent, right? And that's a very big problem. I mean, you know, speaking from the trenches, right? Again, there is absolutely no merit or infinitesimal merit to what Acacia is saying about the benefits of their enforcement program. I've talked to far more startup companies and inventors and mid-sized companies, right, who have either been, you know, or app developers whose activities have been completely curtailed and shut down because of this threat and these demands for, you know, $10, $20, $30, $40, $50,000 on a serial basis. And, you know, I can easily see how organizations like Acacia or IPNav or some of these other organizations can come up with these rationales. And to me, that's all they are. They're just rationales to justify excessive rent seeking by private parties.
Well, there's a fascinating story along those lines from Adi Kamdar at EFF this week that just goes to show how successful the trolling business model has then, because now tech startups, and Lee was talking about, you know, how easy it is to shake them down. Now they are seeing themselves so much painted into a corner that they are tempted to, and Adi's article here talks about two who have actually done this, partner up with non-practicing entities to gain access to their portfolios to be able to fend off litigation from other trolls. So in this particular case, he's talking about Nest Labs entering into a licensing agreement with Intellectual Ventures. Yeah, and then eyeglass startup Ditto partnering up with Eric Spangenberg, as you mentioned, offering to cover Ditto's legal fees in exchange for equity in the company. So now, I mean, the business model has been so successful,
right?
But not only are they shaking them down in litigation.
They want a piece of equity, and it's a shakedown. You know, I don't really care what Peter Detkin say. He's a troll. He coined the word patent troll, but he's a troll. Mm-hmm. You know, he can, you know, publicly look everybody in the eye and say they don't sue anybody, although they've started to sue people. But, you know, they derive tremendous benefit basically by asserting litigation. You know, they have created models where they can derive a lot of economic benefit from you know, volume litigation filings. But, you know, in Nest is a very unusual startup. It's extremely well funded and it's got a ton of cash, and they're essentially paying protection money to IV. And sadly, the fact that you pay this protection money doesn't really mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that you're immune from getting sued. When the troll sues a company, the fact that you developed patents and you have a patent portfolio of your own doesn't give you any sort of leverage against this troll, because the troll has nothing for you to countersue against. They don't make anything, right? So if a troll were to sue Nest and they happen to have some patents that could read on some Nest activities, the fact that there's IV behind it, the troll suing Nest may or may not offer IV professional courtesy, and not sue a company that's in the portfolio of IV, right? And so
honor
what's
among
IV,
trolls.
Yeah, I mean, what's IV going to do? Countersue a shell entity with absolutely no business activity? Nest is, again, very unusual. They're extremely well-funded, so they can afford to pay. And big companies kind of, unfortunately, they pay huge amounts in protection money to the mega trolls like the network managed by Spangenberg, to Acacia, to IV. Smaller companies, unfortunately, just real startups, with bootstrapped, they don't have that luxury. I guarantee you Ditto's venture funded, right? Mm-hmm. They just don't have that luxury to consider some of those options of buying into protection pools. And these small companies, in fact, sometimes to add injury to insult, these small companies are forced to cross-license their patents to a troll to get out of litigation. What a joke, right?
Yeah.
Total joke. I have to say, trolls are very, very entrepreneurial. The founders of trolls are very entrepreneurial. Eric Spangenberg's a very entrepreneurial guy, except I think that there are certain ways of making money and there's other ways of making money. There are lots of ways to make money, and there are ways that add a net benefit to society, and there are ways that, frankly, in my opinion, constitute nothing more than advantage taking. And unfortunately, our system of laws, it enables and permits serial advantage taking by the plethora of lawyers, who are licensed to practice law in America.
All right. Well, before we get into talking about reform and how we can aid this situation, I do want to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and it is ProXPN. ProXPN, if you're not yet using them, is a global virtual private network that works through almost any internet connection and creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So if you don't want to be taken advantage of by folks who may want to grab your passwords or otherwise invade your privacy, this is the tool you need to check out. You're going to have complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose. You protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule. So if you find yourself in the position where you do not want to get caught up in the red tape of dealing with a six strikes kind of process, even though you're engaged in perfectly valid and legal activity on your connection, this might be a good solution for you. You can keep your personal internet usage private at work. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked sites, bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. It makes your internet connection region-free. Its programs for Windows and Mac offer advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. There's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN, so you've got to check that out if you're on the Android side of things. There's world-class customer support, so if you have any questions about what's going to work with ProXPN, if you have some other filter that you want to remain in place and yet you still want to use ProXPN, they're going to be there for you and help you figure out the best way to apply their product in your situation. Steve Gibson loves this product. You need to check out his thorough review of it on Security Now. And you need to head over to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are usually $9.95 a month or $74.95 for the whole year. But there's no need to pay that. You can use this code, TWIL, and you'll get 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days and get a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit, sign up with the code TWIL, TWIL. Thank you so much, ProXPN, for your support of This Week in Law. We love this sponsor. You guys really need to check it out. All right, so we're going to talk about how to make things better. There are a huge number of patent reform proposals pending right now. And for a full list of that, actually, there are so many on deck at the moment. EFF has actually wrangled up all of them in one place if you want to take a look. And you can find that and all the other stories that we're discussing today, a whole bunch of background on Newegg's legal battles at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/229. All our discussion points for this show will be right there. So we're definitely moving towards patent reform. Congressmen and senators are talking about it. Lee, do you think that any of the legislative proposals are ones that your company is going to get behind, that you think other people can get behind?
Every single proposal to reform the patent laws, patent system, and to address the asymmetry in patent laws. I think, you know, there's some that are probably a little bit more realistic than others. I would encourage every single person, all of your listeners and everybody just to be aware and get involved, because I think that's the most important part of making sure that reform happens sooner or later. Reform is going to occur. These abuses will be curtailed if our republic's going to survive. You know, intellectual property is so important to the future of the United States that the patent trolling phenomenon, which again is quite unique to the United States, you know, is something that will have to be curtailed if we're going to remain competitive with countries that don't have patent trolling. Where private parties, a relatively small number of private parties, are not able to extract this giant private rent on patented intellectual property. But that said, you know, I think it just candidly, within the last probably literally 3-6 months, I become, you know, it's become very, very obvious, just like, you know, it was when the AIA passed. It's very obvious that the anti-reform forces, right, led by trolls and some corporate allies of trolls, they're very focused, and they've always been extremely focused, and they're well fund it because trolling is their livelihood. Inefficiencies in the law, inequities in the law, this is their bread and butter. They have to keep the system alive and perpetuate it as long as possible. And so they've been lobbying hard against reform. And a lot of the lobbying against reform, the arguments against reform, Evan raised a couple of them earlier. I mean, they're the same thing that, you know, built the Bill LaRocks of the world's security class action lawyers raised as well, you know, when they were fighting, you know, against reform of securities laws. I mean, oh, we're standing up for the little guys, you know, the school teacher who, you know, had their savings wiped out. Again, let's take a look at how much the school teachers got versus like the plaintiff's lawyers, right? You know, except now we have a different set of economics where you have investors now in some of these litigation funds and investors in litigation, which is kind of bizarre. But, you know, I think people have figured out some folks think they've structured around some champerty rules and so on. But people need to get involved. People need to make themselves aware that this is actually a daily drain on their personal pocketbooks, because every single time that a troll gets money, that means that some company is going to raise prices. And every single time basically a troll gets money, that means that there's less money to spend on R&D. That means that companies can't hire, startups can't hire, you know, staff to build their products out and to sell their products to their customers. And there's a cost. That's why Newegg continues to fight. We don't get sued a whole lot anymore, because I can pretty much assure a troll and their contingency fee lawyer that we're going to see it through. Not only are we going to see it through, everybody else that they sue, we're going to call them all to tell all of them that they really should consider, consider basically fighting harder to push for justice, And, you know, but still, why do we fight? We continue the fight because it's the right thing to do. We continue this fight because we realize that we're still paying. We're paying more for products from our vendors, which we then have to pass on to our customers, our valued customers, because those vendors are paying off trolls. We pay more for technology that we license because the technology solutions providers are charging us more to cover their costs for fighting or paying off patent trolls. You know, and then ultimately as consumers too, I mean, every single one of us, every time we purchase anything that contains patented intellectual property, which is almost everything, we're paying more. So we continue this fight because it's our corporate responsibility to do so. It's what eBay did. It's what Yahoo did. It's what Cisco's done, you know, and it's what a whole host of other companies have done and organizations have done to allow the society to continue to have the opportunities that we've enjoyed. Our founders are all immigrants that they've enjoyed, you know, that, and unfortunately it's a cycle. And this is the latest legal system advantage taking phenomenon that we have to deal with. And the solution is legislative, the solution's judicial, the solution's administrative. But I want to encourage everybody to keep in mind and to think about trying to add as much friction into the system, you know, against patent trolls as they possibly can. And it starts by, you know, not immediately whipping out the checkbook to pay the toll.
Absolutely. And I wish it were the case that we could just say we don't believe in trolls, and each time somebody did that, one of them would die, but they don't go away that way, unfortunately. Congressman Bob Goodlatte in the House Judiciary Committee this week released a second discussion draft of his bill aimed at abusive patent troll litigation, with a lot of the points that Lee mentioned today, making it easier to recover fees from trolls is in there, having heightened pleading requirements so that you have to put in your court papers in great detail what patents and claims are at issues, so it's just not, you know, easy to rubber stamp a complaint and send it down to court. Also, what products allegedly infringe, when the lawsuit's actually filed. Also, the discovery point. You know, part of the reason these cases are so expensive and difficult is that you get mired down into discovery early on before you can actually get to the merits of the patent and have the court determine whether it's even valid or not. So that point is in this bill too. So I encourage you to go over to EFF and take a look at their discussion of it by Daniel Nazer this week. And also to get in touch with your elected representatives if you think that having this kind of reform is a good idea. Any final words on the patent front before we touch on a couple of other topics and wrap the show, Lee?
No, thank you. I think I've said my piece.
Great. Well, it's been wonderful exploring all this with you. We do have a couple of other stories we'd like to get to. One on the Hollywood front, since we were discussing teachers. Let's make that our tie-in. I guess it's not just the teachers who want to, or not just the patent trolls who want to help out the teachers and make sure that they are well represented. Or I guess it was LARAC that always was making that claim in securities litigation on behalf of the little guy. Here, the entertainment industry, particularly the MPAA, wants to help the teachers teach your kids about copyright infringement, although unfortunately in the elementary curriculum, there's a whole lot of discussion of what not to do, very little discussion, in fact, zero discussion at all of fair use, which they've decided that elementary school kids just can't get their heads around. This is all in draft form. There's a great piece at Wired who got a hold of this draft, discussing how the CCI, the same people who brought you the Six Strikes program from your ISP, are attempting to develop an elementary school curriculum that educates kids about copyright infringement, and particularly on the music and film and sort of Hollywood entertainment focused element of the copyright spectrum there. So, Jonathan, I thought this would be an interesting one for you to take a look at. Of course, this is all in draft form, and the people seem to be kind of embarrassed that it is so content owner focused. And Gigi Sohn, who we've had on the show before from Public Knowledge, who is on the board of CCI, did not want to comment on this at this point because, I think she hasn't actually, what she told Wired is she hadn't actually read through the draft. But it looks like, you know, there's a long way to go here. Let's just hope they go that extra mile, because the draft curriculum right now strikes me as fairly one-sided. What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, it definitely is. I would definitely agree that it is somewhat one-sided, and there's a long way to go with it. You know, Patrick, the Copyright 2.0 show, Patrick and I were talking about this just on Wednesday. And you know, what we basically said is we both, I think, favor the idea of teaching copyright in school. We think there should be a lot more, not just in copyright, but in general, the idea of practical education. And so when we came around to talking about it, it was like, well, we agreed that copyright should be taught in school. It's something they're going to have to deal with and cope with and learn to work with for the rest of their lives. You know, and it's on the long list of things that aren't taught in school that should be, like how to balance a checkbook, how to vote, things like that. It's on the long list of things. Like, I got a 5 on the calculus AP test. All these years later, I can't even tell you what a derivative is. Okay, it just hasn't come up in my life since. But, you know, I'm grateful for the experience, but still, I think I would have liked to learn how to do my taxes, too, at some point. You know, I'm just saying. It might have been nice to throw that in there. So copyright is a great topic to teach, and it's a great topic to even teach at this young age, I think. I think I've read studies when it deals with on the matter of plagiarism that have shown that kids as young as third grade are able to grasp, you know, some of the basics of the idea of ownership of works you create. So that it might actually be a good time to do it, but I think it should be purely fact-based. It shouldn't be trying to be, you know, preach to one side or another. It should be, this is what the law says. It should cover topics like fair use. It should be well-rounded. And at that age, I think it should be a basic overview and just move on. You know, you've got, you know, a long time to go in the education process to keep reaching out to them and to keep, you know, talking about the law. But, you know, my opinion is this, you know, my opinion is basically keep the opinions out of it and focus just on what the law says and sort of the practical implications of it and move on.
Yeah, I agree. And I also really hope that they add a fair use discussion to this and don't line out the ability of elementary school kids to grasp that something is nuanced and may require further exploration, and there's not going to be an easy answer right off the bat.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say this. They're probably right that elementary school students probably can't fully grasp the nuances of fair use, but neither can veteran copyright attorneys. So what hope do we have? When do you say that they're ready for that?
You know, exactly.
If I can add something very quickly, Denise, I mean, the continued efforts of the content industry, and we support intellectual property rights, but their continued efforts to basically, you know, I think optimize their short-term revenue stream, it reminds me very much of their efforts when, you know, VCRs were being invented, you know, to curtail, you know, the utilization of you know, recording devices, time-shifting devices. I think if they are wildly successful in scaring the bejesus out of small children about, you know, copyright violations, about people going to jail without also explaining, you know, what fair use is, and so on and so forth, you know, at some point in time, it's going to if they're wildly successful, it's going to result in those children growing up being deathly afraid to create.
Well,
you know, yeah, run out of good content.
And the sad fact about this is that it is couched in terms of being a creator, that, you know, they have a little graphic with a girl in the schoolyard who has a business drawing dragons. And her business sadly is ruined when her fellow third grader takes a photo of the dragon with her cell phone. And then somehow just by taking the photo, or, you know, they don't say exactly what she's done with the phone photo, but somehow by having other copies of the photo available, it has completely devastated her market for her dragon drawings. So I don't know, Evan, do you want, this is coming down the pipe in California, it looks like, what would you think if there in Illinois, in your kids' elementary school, they took a break from learning long division and started learning about when not to photograph your classmates' drawings?
Well, a couple of different thoughts about this. I mean, I am not surprised at all that Big Content would take this position. And you know what? I guess perhaps expanding my consciousness enough to not really care about it anymore. The fact that they take that position, you know what? It's their pecuniary interest. It's their perspective coming at it, protecting this interest that they have as the incumbent, the incumbency being, you know, everything pre-digital, if you will. So I don't mind them taking that position, and I don't mind them, you know, articulating it. But what I do mind and what does concern me is that it's the form of indoctrination going on through this kind of like corporate propaganda. There's really no other way of talking about it. And I just don't think that that belongs in school curriculum. I'm trying to think of something analogous in another setting, like where a corporate interest or an industry interest is taught as part of the curriculum. And I'm just trying to think of things that are like in the public interest, like, you know, general principles of safety, or general principles of citizenship, getting along. I just can't think of anything else where you know, this sort of enterprise sort of interest is put in there. So that's what bothers me the most about it, and that puts me beyond you know, trying to critique the particularities of what their content says. I mean, yeah, I agree with what Jonathan said, and you know, that sure. People much older than in the sixth grade can't understand fair use all that well. It's pretty nuanced. So I don't care if that makes it in there one way or the other. I just don't like the fact that it's there in the first place, but I'm not going to take umbrage of the fact that this part of the economy takes this position and tries to further this interest.
So you don't think copyright should be taught at all in school? You don't think it's something that should be taught at any grade, any level? It just seems to me like it's something that increasingly they are going to bump into, students are going to interact with. And I feel kind of weird. The only reason I got taught copyright at all was because I went into journalism school and got it my sophomore year in college. You know, it feels kind of weird in the digital age to not know what the rules, you know, for dealing with content are.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would, maybe I'm being too puritanical about this. I would prefer to go and learn about calculus and derivatives and how to conjugate a verb and diagram a sentence and all this stuff and leave the economic interests. I mean, what's bugging me about this is that this seems more like a normative or an ethical issue. And again, mm-hmm. I'm not going so far as to say that there is no place for teaching good citizenship. You know, part of the important component of education is to help our the next generations become a part of society and a functioning, you know, part of it. You know, my kids' school's motto is, you know, they're respectful, responsible, and safe. You know, that's drilled into their heads. And so, you know, I'm not sure that I see the need to go to become any more granular than that with little kids like this to really get these kinds of concepts in here. I would feel much more comfortable sitting with my sons, you know, on the sofa deciding what kind of content to watch together and talk about copyright in that context rather than have the risk of the corporate interest being so formulated and put in them that way to give them the skewed perspective, which, you know, doesn't take into account those of us who are more enthusiastic about things like remix culture and the more liberal approach to intellectual property law.
All right. Well, I'm going to make third grade photography our second passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We hope you're going out there and applying for MCLE credit when we have such great folks as Lee Chang, General Counsel of Newegg, and Jonathan Bailey, the author of Plagiarism Today, and Evan and me chatting about these topics every week. We'd love for you to be able to benefit not just from the fun that we're having here, but also from being able to enhance your understanding of the law on these points. We're going to give you our tips and resources of the week. At this point, we'll wrap up with that. Our tip of the week has to do with Supreme Court opinions and the internet. And the tip would be when you see a citation to a website in a Supreme Court opinion, you shouldn't assume that that website is at all there, operational, and ready for you to review. The Jay-Z that we rock out to here in the world of law and technology is Jonathan Zittrain. And he commissioned a study on link rot in Supreme Court opinions and has found that a vast number of hyperlinks, 49% of the hyperlinks in Supreme Court decisions, no longer work at all. Sometimes you'll get justices linking to videos that enhance your understanding of their reasoning. You'll get them linking to resources, etc. And unfortunately, there's not a good solution for making sure that those things once linked in a Supreme Court opinion actually remain there for posterity. In fact, in the New York Times article on this, there's an example of someone who bought the domain to a defunct link in a Supreme Court opinion and asked, "Aren't you glad you didn't cite this web page? This is what you see when you click through. If you had, like Justice Alito did, the original content would have long since disappeared and someone else might come along and purchase the domain in order to make a comment about the transience of linked information in the internet age." So our tip is if you are the Supreme Court, perhaps follow the lead of the Ninth Circuit and try and have, at least a database of those links that you're keeping them yourself. Or now this is one of our resources of the week. If you are someone who cares about legal citation and having it be durable, Jonathan Zittrain and others are working on a project called PermaCC. Now, this allows writers and editors of legal documents to actually take the link that they want to cite, give it to PermaCC, who then promises, their goal is to keep, we're going to give you a new link and this link's going to be permanent. We're not going to go away. So that's an option for you if you do a lot of legal writing.
There's also there's another site that does something very similar. It's called webcitation.org. Mm-hmm. They provide a very similar service. They've been around for a long time. They actually target academia more than the legal field, but no reason they can't be used for that as well. So maybe something to consider. They're also running a crowdsourcing campaign to expand their operation.
I like it. And then, so in addition to PermaCC, we're going to point you toward a Google Hangout that is being hosted this coming week by the EFF. It involves the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They're going to do sort of a session where you can learn more about the TPP's copyright provisions and their impact on users, their effect on U.S. copyright law, and working together to protect access to materials. That's going to be on Tuesday, October 1st at 2 p.m. Pacific time over on Google. And again, we'll put the link to that in our delicious discussion points if you want the direct link to where you should go to participate in that hangout. That's delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/229. And finally, our final tip for you is to dress chicly and send a message when you do. Over at Newegg, they have a great t-shirt that echoes a lot of the sentiments we covered here on today's show. The shirt basically just says, don't settle. And settling feeds trolls. So if
this is great, but I'm not going to buy one, but I will buy one that would say either, that's a bunch of crap, or seriously, screw you. That would be, I'll buy either one
of those. I've trademarked that.
Yeah. For $19.99, that would be a bargain. But Lee, you are going to, you have a fund that some of the proceeds of this are going to.
Yes. All of the proceeds, the profit from the sale of these t-shirts will be used to invalidate some crappy patent.
Good. And Lee, I've got to say, yes, your language is so refreshingly adroit for a lawyer and a general counsel. In addition to being very straightforward with us here today, I love the quotes that made their way into some of the Ars Technica coverage of your legal battles, which include patent trolls as scum-sucking douchebags. Nobody having to, once the sovereign case was done, nobody had to pay. Well, it's not quite done, but hopefully when the Supreme Court denies cert, if that indeed happens, nobody has to pay jack squat on those patents anymore. And of course, TQP development, somebody else that you're litigating with, shouldn't wuss out and should have the balls to go to trial. So I love a lawyer who talks like you talk, Lee. It's very refreshing.
It saves time.
It does. All right. Well, in the interest of saving time and getting on to the next show on the network, we're going to go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It has been a really great pleasure chatting with you all today. I learned a ton. I hope you guys did too. Lee, keep fighting the good fight. It's been really a thrill to talk with you today.
Thank you, Denise. Thanks, Evan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it was lots of fun.
And Jonathan, always a great thrill to talk to you too. And I know a unique thrill at this time of year, because this is about when you get busy prepping for Halloween, is it not?
Yeah, we are. The haunted house is almost done with the construction. We're moving into the decoration phase. Hopefully, knock on wood, I think the flyers for the haunt just arrived while we were on the podcast. I think I heard my dog snarling at something. So I have to go check that when we get offline. But yeah, so it's the busy time right now.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll have a lot of trolls in the house, because there's some scary ones
not
out there.
Not patent trolls, just the good ones, right? Ones that hide under bridges.
Yes. Evan, always is great to talk to you.
Yes, lots of fun. This has really been illuminating, Lee. It was so fun to hear your first person perspective, because the new egg story is one that we talked about, Denise, how many times on the show as the different stories were happening. So it's kind of a little bit of a weird and certainly awe-inspiring perspective to actually have a participant in such kind of a high level story to actually hear so much insight into it. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it. So it's been a lot of fun.
And I have to take a moment, too, to thank our intern who is waiting for his bar results right now, Sando, for his suggestion and for lining up Lee for us today. San has been doing an amazing job suggesting people to be on the show and working on our bookings and otherwise helping us out. And we had a wonderful intern over the summer, Rebecca Klosner, as well. So we really appreciate it when people volunteer to help out the show. God knows we need it. we really appreciate you guys. We would not have had this show today, but for San's suggestion that we get Lee on. So, really great that you guys are helping us out. And we love that our audience helps us out every week too, by getting in touch with us in various ways. You can find Evan and me on Twitter. He's Internet Cases there. I'm D Howell there. Or you can email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He's Evan at twit.tv. Or head on over to our Facebook page or our Google Plus page. Give us your suggestions, your thoughts about shows gone by, your thoughts about what we should talk about in the future. This is how we put together our rundowns each week and decide who to have on and what to discuss. So it's a very participatory thing for all of us, and we really, really appreciate the audience engagement that you give us. We really couldn't do the show without you doing that for us. Also, if you're interested in going back and looking in some of the old shows, you can find them all at twit.tv/twill. You can find this episode just as soon as it's out of post-production, as well as going back to the beginning of our doing the show. You can also find us on YouTube at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. You'll find us on Roku and in iTunes and basically wherever you like to consume your netcast-oriented entertainment. We're going to be there for you. And we're going to be there for you next week when we come back at 11 o'clock Pacific time to record our next episode. We hope you'll join us then, and we will see you next week. Take care.